So, dear Mr. Vigneron, I'm so happy to welcome you here, and you are a Frenchman.
I am.
But I'm going to speak with you in English.
Yes.
That's okay.
It's absolutely okay.
And can I call you Cyril?
Yes, of course. Okay. Asita.
And I am Asita.
Yes. It's my honor to be here with you. So thank you for having me.
Thank you. I'm very honored. Thank you so much for making time to come here. I'm very honored that you accepted to come to my podcast to have a conversation about life lessons and about women rights and leadership, because it's very important what you're doing, and I've been moved and touched and impressed by your commitment to advancing women as CEO of Cartier Foundation. Could you tell me and also the listener more about what the vision is of Cartier Foundation and why do you like to do it?
So there was some part which are deeply ingrained in some of Cartier and what Cartier is and what has been in the years and what it can be, what it stands for. And also there were many personal things in this as well. So when you come to a role of a global CEO, then there is some latitude to move things in a different way. So Cartier is both started as a family business, and even if it was reacquired in the 1960s and then has grown international group, but I think the spirit of the family members, and especially on a period which was 1920s, when there was an important couple, Louis Cartier and Jeanne Toussaint. So they were scandalous for their time, but they are very modern today. So he was kind of following his family obligations and had married not so happily, then got separated, and he met Jeanne Toussaint, who was struggling her life. So she lived in Belgium and came to France, having to do scandalous things at that period to survive, and had very strong character. So you had, even in the 1920s, kind of a man of heart and a strong-headed woman. And they made together a very strong couple to try to define new things of identity, of aesthetics, curiosity to the world and things. So getting inspired by that, then you had naturally a brand maison, which was equally masculine or feminine, but doing jewelry also mostly linked to women, but anchored to the real world and seeing the real world and trying to make it more beautiful.
From what you're telling me, the identity of the founders of Cartier is very, their life story is also very strongly linked to the definition of the company, and also the heritage and the energy that is now in Cartier Foundation. And what is motivating you and driving, your passion and commitment to the cause of aesthetics and freedom?
So also this couple, in the 1920s, they also looked back to mythology, and they anchored in some way the kind of Cartier core with love and beauty. On my kind of first year as the head of Cartier, when we had the year-end party, I used the Primavera di Botticelli as the example of what Cartier is about. In the center of that, you have a woman who is Venus, but she's pregnant. And on top of her, there is Eros. So it's a love and beauty is not necessarily say we love what is beautiful, but it's love makes you beautiful. And love transformed the world in a beautiful way. So we say, Cartier, we say also said a magician, what Jean Cocteau has said, it's not an illusion, it's the magic of really transforming things to be better. But if you have that kind of view, then you have to see also what is not beautiful and try to do something as a corporate citizen. So before I arrived, there was an initiative that had started, which is now the 20th anniversary this year, and we start to have the kickoff on the International Women's Day in a few days from now, of Cartier Women's Initiative, which was to recognize in the world social entrepreneur women who were doing some business, but to make the world a better place. So meaning going with the sustainable development goals and having their activation all around the planet. And it started close to the World Economic Forum, the Women Economic Forum, but then developed at its own, and we could also make it bigger. There were also some element of philanthropy, to say, how if we are, especially in luxury, but also privilege, how also to care for the or the underprivileged, especially often women and children. Initially was to do some fundraising, some charity gala, some also some collections that you can take the profits to give to some NGO. but decided nicer 15 years ago to create a specific foundation called Cartier Philanthropy, where funded every year based on the company's result. Mm-hmm. And then with that, we go for impact-driven philanthropy, supporting NGOs around the world on multi-year programs.
Still inspired by the original story.
It was inspired by the original story.
That you're very passionate about. Look, this is like more like almost like a poem, and then it leads me to the question to you, like, you know, Cartier is in the luxury business.
Yes.
Today, when you speak about art and when you speak about luxury, sometimes I have the impression that people think, well, it's not something that humanity needs. People need maybe just food, or there is a misconception about luxury business and about art. People think like this is what we want when we have everything else. What do you think? Can people assume that luxury is superfluous, or is it actually important for transforming humanity? Or is luxury something that is positive, or is it something that is actually controversial? What would you like to say that luxury is, from the artistic point of view, or from your point of view, how you see it when you hear all these different perspectives?
So all the words you have used in some way are used from time to time to talk about luxury.
Yeah.
So my definition of luxury is luxury starts when necessity stops, but not in a negative way. Mm-hmm. Because if we see what remains on humanity from 5,000 years, from ancient Egypt and Greece or Persia or China, other parts which are not necessary. What makes us human is to cooperate at scale to make things that transcend ourselves on something that overlaps us and are really, truly beautiful. So we keep palaces, but we keep also architecture, houses, paintings. What we are amazed when we go to see the Roman old villa in Pompeii is a refinement of those paintings and people and literature and what else we have transmitted through time. So in some way there is this question, what is necessity about? But even on that, the old Greek philosophers have come to say, if you try to find what is absolutely necessary, you just come to mere survival. And even that, when it was kind of a Diogenes in his barrel, I say, I need nothing. But if you need nothing, you create nothing either. So we need things to survive. We need air, we need water, we need food, we need clothes, we need heat. And these are the part of condition. And so the problem, when you don't have that, then there is no humanity possible. Mm-hmm. So that's where also in philanthropy, you have to say for those who are deprived for access to critical resources have to be helped. There's a question of human solidarity. Mm-hmm. But when you go beyond that level of what is really necessary, what do we aim for? We aim for what is not necessary for survival, but necessary for our soul. Mm-hmm. What makes us happy is what is not useful. We're not happy when used by a shampoo or by just driving a car. We're happy with love. We're happy with art. We're happy sometimes with sports. We're happy with achievement, with going beyond the limits. Mm-hmm. That's why human beings are going to the moon. That's why they climb on mountain. That's why they, even for 3 weeks, every 4 years, they, get so excited by people running and jumping and kicking balls and so forth. It's not useful. What makes us happy is what is not useful.
It's so beautiful what you're saying. I was sure that I was going to be excited by listening to you about knowledge, about history, about art.
So that's why there can be a part of, say, and it's called utilitarianism. Mm-hmm. Should we go for only what is useful? But when you go only to that, then we get depressed.
Yes.
We have to go, we need beauty in our life. We need something more. Of course, if luxury comes to pure consumerism, that you try to consume more and more things that you don't need and don't even
like. Then it becomes basic.
That's the problem.
Yeah.
Because luxury is also something normally that goes, it takes time to make. It takes time to appreciate. And you want to keep it for a long time. You want to transmit to your children. Mm. So when you come to this part of transcendental luxury, it's only beautiful.
Yes.
Of course, if you do things which are not beautiful, which are just kind of not respectful of people, of the environment, or
then
so forth,
it cannot be beautiful.
No. So that's where, say, beauty is moral beauty.
Yes.
You have to do beautiful things in a beautiful way. And if you don't do that, then you don't meet your promise.
You know, I was, when I was, let's say, in my 20s, you know, at that age when you are just effortlessly keeping your wife and everything. I like to buy notebooks. When I arrive in a city that I don't know, the first thing I do is to buy a notebook in a shop. I just like to have it. I can actually kind of a little bit addicted to buying notebooks everywhere I go. And then I buy always something that is looks different from what I have. And I found this notebook that has a metallic cover.
Yes.
And on the metallic cover, there was a photo of the painting, a painting of Monet about Venice. And I found it so beautiful. It made me instantly very happy. I stared at it maybe for like 5 minutes, and then I bought it. And I opened it, and I even found a more beautiful surprise, because inside it was written, there was a quote, now I forgot who is the author of this quote, but it was written, beautiful young people are accident of nature, and beautiful old people are work of art. And then I thought,
I love this.
That is beautiful. I love this. But then I was cleaning my house last week, and I saw it, and I'm like, that's really true. I'm now going to the gym. Like, and then you see, like, because of art they're putting it, they came with a sentence, they came with something that can inspire you, and if it stays in the corner of your house, it can inspire you later as well. And then it led me to wonder, while I was like listening to a podcast about art, and about, I thought, oh, I'm going to listen to that. And then there was this discussion between two people who were saying, is necessity to be defined? And is, you know, they had the conversation that we had now, and then they reached the point where is necessity to be defined? And then when you speak about all the things you said now, then the question rises in me too, what is useful? When is it maybe different depending on are we hungry or not, how we feel, and what is necessary? Because maybe that is subjective even within the life of one person. Maybe at a certain point, art and luxury is something that is nice to have. And then at a certain point, imagine a woman who is victim of violence and who puts some lipstick on and discover that actually I am warfare, and feel something different, then it's maybe transformative, maybe necessary in that situation.
Yes.
When is necessity objectively defined?
Well, necessity in this case have some part which can be objectively defined, meaning if you don't have air for more than 3 minutes, water for more than 3 days, and food 3 weeks, you die.
That's clear.
So that's very clear that this part. If also you don't, you cannot dress yourself properly and be kept in a heating condition that is fine, you also die if it's too hot or too cold or so forth. So there are elements which are really necessary for survival. Then the question that for human dignity, everyone needs respect and dignity.
Yeah.
If you don't have that,
then, and love.
And so love is part of it.
Yes.
But there is a kind of a minimum respect, and that's where, when you think about universal rights, there are universal rights for men, for women, for children, for everyone. You see, wedding is the most beautiful things in life, but not when you're 13 years old, forced to marriage, deprived of love, mother at 14, and at the moment can be even very dangerous for the body.
Yes.
But you have not been allowed to live your own life.
No.
It's not beautiful.
Then it's not beautiful. It's
so this element of respect and dignity are part of necessity to be human being, be human being. There is still something like 40, 50 million of modern slaves.
Yeah.
And also slavery is depriving of human dignity.
Yeah.
So there are elements where say it's part of necessity. That's why there is universal declaration of human rights.
When we come back to the example you gave, I'm so grateful that you brought this example up, because that's also how we met. Child marriage, justice for children, for women and girls, equal access to justice, being the topic of the UN this year as well. For this year, International Women's Day is about access to justice, and if we cannot all of us have the same access to justice, then there is no justice. When you speak about this child who could be 13 years old and forced to marry, I was born in Burkina Faso. More than the half of Burkina is like in the top ranking countries where child marriage happens the most. I saw children getting married when I was a child myself, and getting taken out of the classroom to disappear and then become someone's fourth or fifth wife, someone who could have the same, who had to actually be with their father, and who is actually not from close to their generation, mm-hmm. and they become a servant and subjected to the will of that person, and have children at a very low age, really dangerous mm-hmm. life. And I think this is one we're working on, fighting on. And when we met at first, it was mm-hmm. about empowering women both at home and at work.
Absolutely.
So I would like you maybe to say, like now you have been for a long time head of Cartier itself, and then you moved to Cartier Philanthropy, mm-hmm. that is investing in this transformative need in society. Is it different to manage an organization like a Cartier Philanthropy compared to Cartier as a business? And also, when you look at how the global level we're advancing about empowering these girls, what is an example that you would like to share that Cartier Philanthropy has achieved or would like to achieve in this? Because this is very important that we team up with businesses to advance women in terms of justice, and when they have a job, then they have a life.
So many questions.
I know, I'm so excited. I wish we had the whole day, but we only have some short time for the podcast. But let's see what we can say
about
it.
The way we approached the philanthropy, I say, and it had moved out of just doing some fundraising and then giving mm-hmm. and then not knowing what would go on.
Yeah.
But you say, if we apply the same kind of approach you can do for impact-driven philanthropy compared to what you do in the business, meaning doing something where you do the right thing and you measure the result and you try to continuously improve.
Mm-hmm.
Some businesses can be more linked to kind of maximize profit all the time. Mm-hmm. But this should not, especially when you're in the world of beauty, you have to make beautiful things for beautiful people. When they're not nice enough, you do them again. Mm-hmm. You continuously try to improve. Mm-hmm. If you say the Cartier Philanthropy will have substantial fund, but nothing to compare with some other foundation who have more zeros,
mm-hmm.
I say, how can support in the long run some NGOs and then have a due diligence process to say, what is your model? What are you trying to achieve? Are you meeting your goals? How can you help them mm-hmm. to go one step further and then also to be more visible so that they can scale them up? And there are two examples on NGO that we have supported, because Cartier Philanthropy doesn't do things on their own.
Mm.
Cartier Philanthropy goes to fund some NGOs and to support them in the long
run.
You
empower them.
And then you identify, spot them, empower them. Mm. In the same way we do for Cartier Women's Initiative, empowering young entrepreneurs to meet their goal.
Mm-hmm.
And we help them helping themselves.
Yeah, you enable them actually.
Yes. So one of the best case with the Educate Girls in India,
mm-hmm.
when they were the absolutely amazing CEO, Safina Hussain, who was concerned that in a big part of south of India, girls don't go to school, meaning they are taken out.
They have to stay home, cook, and do
cook chores. And because the parents think that they were very soon anyway, at young age, they will be married, they will leave the house, so they invest on boys
mm-hmm.
and girls, say, no need.
Yeah.
But when you have girls who are not educated,
mm-hmm.
then even after marriage, because of the lack of education, the risk for them to be sick is quite high.
Yeah.
The risk of child mortality is going to be 5 to 10 times
Absolutely.
More. And then the circle of poverty remains.
Yes.
So, see, we have to keep those girls in school. So I started to go to villages where you have to convince the parents, you have to convince the mayor and the town. I say it's a good thing for them, also providing some clothes or food so that it would not be a kind of economic burden. And so started with 5,000 girls in 100 village. And it worked super well. They stayed at school and they improved also the family economics in the end. So then we started to support that at early stage. It moved from 5,000 girls to 50,000. And now it's 1.5 million girls from all the south of India who have been kept at school for now many years and go to the primary and secondary education.
This is so beautiful.
Because after seeing the result, which can be proven, then the school foundation and UN founded them. So she moved from few million dollars to $50 million in a few years.
So even locally, you had some buy-in for people to join the
and
initiative.
And then, they said it was, so then seeing also the result, that then after a few years, could see that also the villages were more prosperous as well.
Yes.
Then could identify, using AI as well, the areas where there was a discrepancy, the number of students and so forth, to go to these 100,000 villages basically everywhere.
And
using the some families, parents also who come to advocate to become the foster parents for
the other. So the people who benefited from this initiative became some advocates as well in their own community, so you empowered the community to become self-supportive in having access to education. What you're saying really touches my heart, because it's so, people usually in certain traditions, you know, I had it also when I was a child, invest more in boys than in girls, and also because they think the girl is going to work somewhere, is going to become someone else's wife, and it's expensive and useless anyway. So we're going to invest only in boys. You know what it makes me think of? I remember, you know, in when I was growing up in Africa, we had so many issues with malaria, especially whenever it rained, there would be too many mosquitoes and we'd have malaria. Mm-hmm. And then my mom had us. My mom had us. We were six when she was 35. I mean, she was, you know, she was 20 when I was born. And so, like, you know, about 20, even maybe younger. So, you know, I would see her. She didn't have glasses. She would like put like the very tiny texts from medicine. You know, the she would took the notice and she's like, ah, she lila notice, and she would come very close and she was reading to see the posology of the medication that we needed to take. And we were like all waiting, and then she would give us the medication, and then we take it, and knowing that she knew what she was doing, and then we were perfectly aware that other moms at the exact same time had to give medicine to their kids, even if they thought of it, but they didn't know how to. Mm. And I was like, if you don't even know how to read this document, how do you, if you don't even know that you should read it before you give the medicine to your kid, you really don't know what to do. It's totally, and your child can just die of malaria because you don't know what the dosage is of chloroquine that you need to give. So I was feeling blessed when I look back. We've been so lucky that my mom could read. Mm. And then when recently she was receiving a voice call from WhatsApp from one of her sisters, and then I'm like, show her to me, can you show? And she has only one photo of the sister, and it's a photo of the identity card, and it's written down, illiterate, cannot read. Mm. So that is like, and then the profession is ménagère. I'm like, oh my God, that's how we describe women. So what you're doing is transforming them to even the definition that is stick to them is something else. That one can, that to be able to write can save your life, your kid's life. It's so concrete.
Another element about redefining also a narrative, it's also come from home, where say in areas many mothers also inhibit. So they say, don't teach your boys to shine and your girls to serve. Teach both of them to shine and serve. Mm-hmm. Boys can cry. Girls do not be afraid to be bossy, but they have all to make their choice. Mm-hmm.
Nobody ever says boys are bossy, actually, when I think of, they always think it's girls.
They are driven. Boys are driven, girls are
girls
bossy.
But you, in your experience, that's very good that you bring this up, in your experience as a leader, I wanted to know which is, for example, the link, the historic link between Cartier and empowering women is actually embodied by even the founders of Cartier, and it's something that drives you. Did it also influence your vision about leadership?
Yes, it did, because the leadership needs diversity, and there is a part where empowering women enlarges the scope of what we can do. So there are some areas where, because of the culture, you can have a kind of a majority of men, and even if Cartier was dealing with women and had a very kind of feminine part of history, even in the regions, you had in the boutiques, in the store, majority of women. But then for management, it was mostly men. Mm-hmm. 20 years ago, there was only one woman who was managing director. And even 10 years ago, when I became global president, there were 20%, only five, in smaller market. Mm-hmm. I say, we have to close the gap. Mm-hmm. There is enough pipeline, there is no reason. We have to convince those women that they should not feel the imposter syndrome, because many don't claim for the job because they think they are not fit. Mm-hmm. And so if we encourage them to say that they are perfectly right candidate for it.
So you brought a new vision that is quite
feminist. Vision, and we brought a kind of parity in the region. So all the big regions, including China, Japan, Korea, Middle East, where also people say, no, these cultures are too dominantly masculine, it's too difficult for women. broad women, who were mothers, who were kind of a perfectly balanced, and they had fantastic results.
Did you face some challenges? Because when we talked before having this interview, when I met you in Geneva, we had a very good conversation. You know, I discovered so many. You have such a rich perspective on life, and with so much diversity in skills and in inspiration sources. So when you tried to implement that in your work as a leader, did you face challenges? Did you face resistance?
So yes, we face different kind of challenge and resistance. Let's say the first that the women I wanted to promote, they were not feeling ready. Mm-hmm. So because they were taught for a long, long time that you have to stay at your place, you should not aim too high. Mm-hmm. And this is called, you know, the imposter syndrome. And it's mm-hmm. one of the topics we will raise with these 20th anniversary conferences, that some men do feel it, but mostly women, because mm-hmm. men are kind of a driven or are dedicated to say you have to be ambitious and to show up. So they even show up more than their capacity, where women are taught to be reserved, to be quiet, and so forth. So even if they are perfectly capable, they feel
they underestimate themselves.
So they feel they have to overachieve and so forth. Yeah. So we had made this program to say the first part, women to women, mm-hmm. they're talking about their childhood, their parents, what had been pushed on them that was difficult. And they realized, most of them, that they were all the same. Mm-hmm. So it gave them confidence to say, I can do it. Yeah. So that, but then the first part was that to overcome mm-hmm. this imposter syndrome. Mm-hmm. Then the second part would be the rest of the organization to say...
To change as well. Huh?
Yeah, because the other would say, if there are no women in this position, there must be a reason.
Yes.
Because it's too difficult for women. So because it's the first, and they would say, it's risky. Let's say, if you say this, never change.
No.
So I say, I take the risk. Mm-hmm. And I will empower them and will see that they are doing fine.
And for yourself too, as a new leader of Cartier, and you want to do this change, then it means that you also have chosen to not be the man that people were waiting for,
yes.
but to be a new kind of man.
Yes.
So, and how did people welcome this new man?
Well... Some welcome very well,
yes,
and some not so well, and because also when you start to promote women this way, then some men feel threatened. Mm. They will say, "No, we have different kind of competition. Yeah. It will be more difficult for us." Mm. There was some moment when people say, "If you're not a woman in this company, you cannot be promoted," which was not true, mm-hmm. but they kind of try to have backfire of saying, "You know, it's something that is taken from us."
Yeah, yeah.
And for men. Some were seeing that as liberation.
Yeah.
I say, well, we can see that men can be kind and successful. Yeah. You don't have to be cruel. So it gave a role model in a different way. So some really saw that as really a chance,
yeah.
and others were threatened.
Yes.
Because men are afraid of not being perceived as real men. But there's nothing as real men. We're just men.
Yeah, so they thought maybe you were the person who were not the real man, maybe.
So I was, but when in my youth, I was bullied.
Yeah.
By being too sweet.
Because they expected you to be the boy who doesn't cry, the boy who
is the bossy. Because the men say you have to be bossy, you have to be cruel, you have to fight. And if you don't show your fist, it means that you're too kind.
Yeah.
So, and some men can be...
I'm so sorry you were bullied.
But I overcame.
Yes.
And I was helped by my mother, who was very strong. Mm. You know, my mother, when she was a teenager, she wanted to do medical doctor studies. Her father told her, no, it's not suitable for a woman.
For women.
Having such a character in a woman's body is monstrous. That's what he told her.
Wow.
She was 15, but she didn't even, she was not even angry at him because she said, he tells that because he loves me, but I would anyway go my life. Mm-hmm. And so she went anyway to study, not as medical doctor. She could go to something with a director's assistant, like secretary, mm. but then she moved to HR, and then she moved to politics. She was a town hall councillor.
Wow.
She went to politics, and I was really kind of had admiration for her. 60 years ago, she had to get my father's approval to sign a work contract. Every time there was something happening, we say, does your husband agree on what you do? And it was not so long ago.
Yeah, so long ago. Women couldn't even open a bank account. Not so long ago.
And you've seen on the portrait, Simone Veil, I remember, in 1980s, when she came to the laws about abortion, about the right of women to decide on their own body or their own life. This was very new. But so I saw that, and I saw what my mother achieved. And I thought, you know, you must have strength. Not be afraid of being sensitive or being who you are. See, we all have the right to become who we are. But I wanted to show also when I became global CEO, you can be like this and become successful.
You can be a new man.
And
be
become a
CEO,
new man.
Be inspired by your mother, not necessarily by a man. And so we can actually be flexible and live.
And I also said I believe in the return on kindness more than return on investment, return on ideas, and return on openness with something which can be both ambitious but compassionate and full of care.
Yeah.
And it has worked.
And then I wonder, you know, when you look at that, this is so inspiring, Cyril. I'm sure that people want to know more later. So I hope to really have you again when we have events. What human aspect of your personality did help you in a very difficult, in making it very, handling or making a very difficult decision in your career?
Well, there have been several kind of difficult decisions in the career and several difficult decisions as a global leader.
Mm-hmm.
So many decisions in my career was, you go to plan A, there is no plan B.
Mm-hmm.
And you have to trust life to do that. So I say, things are what they are. If I think that the status quo is not fine, I want the change to happen, then you have to accept to go to something where you don't know.
Mm-hmm.
So not be afraid of the unknown, but just try. Mm-hmm. And of course, when being married and then there was a question of, say, of course, your choice can also impact others. So always consulted with my wife and to say, do you agree that we do that?
Mm-hmm.
So when I had left Cartier and Richemont, was back to Japan with LVMH, and I was called back 2 years later, I said, do you want to come back to Cartier? I said, no, I've left. And do you want to come back as global president?
Of course.
Okay, but I have to ask my wife.
Yes.
And say, because we were happy to be back in Japan. She's Japanese.
And you are a team as well.
Yes. Yeah, and
the
so
family
she said,
front.
But of course, I think you want it. So, and I think it would be good for both you and the company. So, of course, I will support that. So when we came back to Geneva, and when we moved to Geneva, we were living in Paris before. And so arrived in the middle of winter. And then she told me something which was really important. She said, don't complain. We all came back here. We all come to this city. We were in Tokyo. It was beautiful sky, weather, and so forth. Here it's dark. We don't know anyone. It will be hard for each and every of us, me and the kids. So we'll all walk our ways. But don't bring your problem at home.
Oh.
And she was right.
It was a good...
She was right.
Yeah, they were very open to share with you.
Yes,
I heard that your daughters are also very direct with you, like, Dad, this is like this. You have four daughters, right?
Or yes, and I have three daughters and one son.
Yeah, three daughters and one
but
son.
But also to see another difficult moment as a parent.
Yeah.
So I got divorced when we were in Japan. So my ex-wife and my two daughters went back to France. And so then with my Japanese wife, now we've been together for 25 years, so it's a long long part with two other children.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
At some point came back to France, and when I was in Japan, I wanted to see my daughters. So every 6 weeks I would fly for the weekend to spend the weekend with them.
Mm-hmm.
And so we could keep our bonding in a very nice way.
Yeah.
But when we came back to France, they would come every other week at home, but the life was with the small ones.
Yes.
And you know, the small ones drive the agenda, and they make you tired. And
then so the older ones felt like they didn't get enough of your time.
Exactly. And so she called me for lunch. And
how old was she, your daughter?
She was 17.
And she asked you, come, Dad, I want to have lunch with you.
Yes, and she was in tears.
Wow.
Say, I don't have enough of your time. We have disappeared of your mental...
Priorities.
And so I say, I had to change. Because it was... Life is a question of necessity, balancing necessity.
How did you feel when she said that? Were you surprised?
I was surprised.
That she took the initiative?
That she took the initiative, that she got the courage to say it.
Wow.
Then I felt really feeling bad of not having seen that to begin with. So I was hurt, I was in tears as well.
Wow. And so then, you showed her also, she saw you in tears as well.
And then I said, I will do something different. So that we have a lunch. Every other week together, and the other week with your sister, we'll have at least a dinner every 2-3 weeks. We'll have some holidays together, and we will do that.
And she agreed with the plan.
She agreed with the plan, and I kept the plan, and then it was fine too.
I find it so beautiful. Actually, being a better leader at work, embracing the feminine side of life, and not being the classic, almost Cro-Magnon man, allows you to be a better father too.
Exactly,
because your daughter didn't feel. Like scared or out of place, to say that, I want to speak about it. She didn't say, I'm angry, so I don't speak to you anymore. She said, let's address this. So you empowered her by your,
yes,
by embracing your fragility, your you know, the human side, to also actually approach you with something that was making her not see herself as weak or exaggerating.
And so you can be a CEO, but you have to see that people around you have necessities.
Yeah.
And it's your family first. And so your daughter is in New York now,
yeah,
and then she's in your mind all the time.
Yes.
And that's a part which is part of us.
Absolutely.
We have to accept it. Then you have also those who are, mm-hmm, also the close people who believe in you,
mm-hmm,
and you have to also take care of them.
So
leadership is care.
Leadership is care.
Energy, courage, and care.
And it is in all the domains of our lives. I mean,
yes,
I cannot be a better a good politician if I'm not a good mother.
And if you
and
don't
I cannot
care.
Be a good, I cannot, you know, I just, you just need to lead every aspect of your life according to the same principles.
Listen to a few things you were saying about violence to women. You care.
Absolutely.
So it's not a posture.
Yeah.
And the things which are most important, what do you care for? And what do you stand for? And what are you ready to stand up for?
And you need to act also upon it. You need to take action. And what I learned from you is that we need to be also, to remember to be emotionally accessible,
yes,
for the people who are closest to us. Because it's not because they're
approachable.
Yeah, it's not because they are physically close at home, like our families, our children, our siblings, that they also feel emotionally, yeah, close, and we need to pay attention to see
there
what
was,
is going on.
There was one thing that touched me very much. It was in one of the year-end party.
Mm.
I had made a speech about movement and friction, how much he wants to let things go at the same time as to control, which,
yeah,
the parents is a constant challenge. How much you should let go and how much you have to put control and protection.
Mm.
And economy and politics, mm, all
everything is the same.
But so give this speech and then went to mingle with people. And there was one woman who came to me and said, can I talk to you? I said, of course you can talk to me. And she said, I've been in this company for 18 years. I'm working in the jury department. I'm a jury myself. And you're the first president that when he talks to me.
Wow. So they hear it. You talk to the heart. Look, which so-called, because I don't like the fact that we said feminine sides and masculine sides. I think we're just like, you know, there is a style. But which kind of so-called feminine type leaderships, aspects of leadership do you think men in the traditional way of defining them should embrace more? Like if you would pick one to say, guys, wake up, just take this one, which one would you pick?
We'll take the part in a different way. Because women have been kept aside from leadership for a long time, then there was a part that had been driven, a kind of perceiving masculine leadership of something which was flexing muscle and cruel and so forth, which is not necessarily masculine. But if we think that now we consider masculine is more competitive and strong, and feminine more compassionate and full of care, I think we need both.
We need both,
so
yes.
Women need to be competitive.
I am absolutely competitive, but I also care.
Exactly. So that's a part where leaders of today need to have both, because it's a world that needs competitiveness, ambition, and they want to get things done.
Whether they are men or women, they need to have both.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
And the other side need to be also sensitive and show care and show compassion.
I like that idea.
But if we think that women are compassionate and they are in role that are compassionate and men are ambitious in role, it doesn't work.
Yeah. We need to actually make sure that as a leader, whether we are a man or a woman, we need to have to make sure that we have compassion, competitivity, care.
You know, if a leader is weak,
emotion,
it doesn't work.
Yeah.
Leaders must be strong. They have
but
courage,
also have all
have
these
wisdom
points.
And
yeah,
have care.
Yeah.
And the part we say, I think, you know, my conviction, each and every human being, the part which is called masculine, feminine, is part of us.
Yeah.
We have to grow both.
And it is very, I realize it is very challenging for men, as you shared. If you want to be a free man, you need actually to free yourself from the traditional, horrible traditional idea of men. Mm. And, you know, and
men are totally
these men are just like Tarzan. I think like we should the women who want them. And, you know, but it is also a challenge both for you to transform as for women to actually embrace their power. So I would like to end, I would like to continue this conversation forever. But
Because men have to accept to their sensitivity, but not feeling weak.
Mm-hmm.
Kindness is not weakness.
Yeah. And vulnerability is not weakness either.
And showing your feeling and showing you can be vulnerable, but then you can overcome, is not a weakness. If you can surf on the wave of your emotion, then you do things which can be great. Look, if you cut down your emotion, you're not in contact with the world.
Because then you cannot be in contact with yourself. How can you be in contact with the world if you can't be in contact with yourself? I would like to go back to beauty, the principle of beauty. We spoke about it earlier, and you said beauty, what I understand is that beauty is something that comes from the inside. We were discussing about the difference between beauty and elegance. Because these terms can be like used, like, you know, depending on the language, in such a different way. So do you think that beauty, when people experience beauty, that bring them to the truth, their true self?
Yes, I think, you know, when we talk about necessity, if you see how people behave when they're in a beautiful environment, when they come to see a beautiful, I don't know, sunset, or when they are in the beautiful cities, they behave better. The sense of beauty is something important to us. So if we can help them to grow that part, then they can come to their true self, not being afraid, and express it in a beautiful way. Of course, they have to show respect to others. If at some point they want to kind of impose their view, it's fine.
Cyril, you also said that beauty is about moral beauty.
Yes. So that's the part coming to the Platonic view of beauty. But beauty is not the opposite of ugliness, but of meanness. Moral beauty is what really matters. And moral beauty shines up. And what we're saying that through age become the work of art is that when you cultivate your own beauty and your own self,
it then comes from the inside and it shines.
If you have loved, if you're loved, and if you're kind of clear to who you are, then it shows beauty outside. Yeah. So beauty is something that comes. Beauty is a becoming. Yeah. As you say, if you just
get
beauty initially, it doesn't last.
Yeah. And you
beauty
said,
that lasts is a becoming.
And you said also earlier in this conversation, we make beautiful things for beautiful people.
Yes.
And I just will just remember that you mean beautiful as opposed to mean people.
Exactly.
You're making to people who actually change the world, change themselves, challenge themselves.
So if we see beauty just as a stereotype or as a superficial appearance, then we're wrong.
Yeah.
It has to be something that comes from within.
Thank you so much. I really loved to have this conversation with you.
I did too.
And I wanted to say also to everyone who is looking at us that you are not only a businessman, a CEO, a philanthropist, but you're also an artist. That is why you could also, you composed this music, you took these beautiful photographs, and this is incredible what you've done. And, you know, this is like, it is amazing. And you actually know how to recite poems by heart. The last time we met was that. And I have a surprise for you, because you are such a book lover, and there is a surprise here, and I would like to give it to you. This is in French. And
I know this book.
I hope you don't have it yet.
I have it.
Oh my God! I need to get.
No, no, but I love it. So
I need to get something new for you then. So you
because
see, it was very difficult to find a book for a poet.
But it's a bad beauty. It's a beauty of imperfection.
Yes.
And I think what we said before, if we see beauty of an aesthetic appearance of something just
and
perfect.
You have, when you see here, it's for artists, designers, poets, and philosophers. What is your favorite poem?
My favorite poem? Well, I have several.
You can pick.
But the one is the same, Hope.
Hope. We can end with that poem.
Yes.
Do you know it?
Yes, I know
so
it.
So let's do the poem.
It's from Emily Dickinson.
Emily Dickinson. Okay, let's listen to that.
Hope is a thing with feathers that perches in the soul and things attune without the words and never stops at all. And sweetest in the gale is heard and sore must be the storm that could abash the little bird that kept so many warm. I have heard it in the chillest land and on the strangest sea, yet never in extremity it asked a crumb of me.
Thank you so much. Your daughters are so lucky, and your son too, because he's going to be a new man like you.